Welcome to the Jiu-Jitsu of Life, a weekly podcast for BJJ enthusiasts who are striving to succeed both on and off the mat. This podcast is brought to you by Roll Bliss Custom Kimonos, makers of the world's finest custom BJJ apparel. And here are your hosts on the Jiu-Jitsu of Life, Carter Fisk and Mo Siddiqui.
Welcome to the Jiu-Jitsu of Life podcast. This is episode number 125.
Take two.
Take two. Yeah, we had all our school. We have a lot more episodes.
Yeah.
We have like 300. They'd be terrible. Instead of 125 rock solid ones like we've had.
It's funny you say that. It's funny you say that because, I mean, that's kind of, you know, what we're going to talk about today a little bit. But, you know, I was meaning more in terms of, because I was thinking about that a lot, because I've been talking about doing deals with a lot of different people.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're people that I want to either, I'm going to share whatever knowledge I have with them that you've given me, I'll give to them. But, you know, but in return, I'd, you know, like for them to reciprocate that, right?
Oh, I remember this conversation.
Yeah. Today. Yeah. And some people have been, man, but you know, like if you're out, if you're already driving around there, if you bird dog a deal, that'd be great, right? But anyways, so I'm kind of, I kind of have like an email set up that I can kind of just send to certain realtors and certain people that are bird dogging or wholesaling, kind of let them know what my criteria is and what my numbers are, right? Yeah. And when you look at my numbers, they're very conservative. And what I tell these people when I'm on the phone with them is that, look, I don't do a ton of deals, right? Like I'm not a volume guy, but I've never lost money on a deal, right? And that's because, and a lot of that just comes from your mentorship, right? Like you don't do maybe a lot of deals. Well, you do a lot of deals, but you know, you're very selective on your deals, right?
Yeah.
And you're not trying to turn a mediocre deal into a good deal. You say no more than you say yes.
Yeah.
But when you do say yes, it's probably because you're going to make good money on the deal. So I don't know where I was going with that. All I know is that I haven't been training. And that's not a good thing. And it showed today. Oh, I'm hurting. No, everyone was getting up like, man, I feel great. Like I got gas in the tank and yep. I didn't want to say anything, but like, I barely made it home. I thought I was going to have to pull over and have EMS come pick me up. My ears, everything hurt. Everything hurts.
Yeah. No, it's tough. You know, we were talking about this before. It's easy to remember the fun parts of training when you haven't been training. You think about it, people are like, oh, I miss training and all that. And that's good. But there's also a reality of training, especially if you've not been doing it for a while, which is that, man, you've got to go through like that period where it's hard. It's so like the gas tank is not full. And it's unfun. And many times you will think to yourself, why am I doing this? And I don't think that ever, that reintroduction thing ever goes away anytime that you quit. No matter how long you've been training, if you quit for even a couple months, getting back in there is always hard. Like regaining momentum is always difficult. And remembering how difficult regaining momentum is something that's very easily forgotten. So people are like, oh, I miss training so much. And then they do it and like, I forgot how much I hated this part of it so much. So there's that. But that being said, I mean, once you get past that, which I think you're already well on your way, then it becomes more fun again. But yeah, it's been tough. And we were talking about this as sort of an overall theme of what we were going to discuss today, which is that finding that sweet spot in training, in business, in life, and all these different things. And training sweet spot to me centers around what your priority is. And your priority could be working out or like strength and conditioning. It could be powerlifting or CrossFit or something like that. It could be long distance running, or it could be something like jiu-jitsu and martial arts and things like that. So if that is the priority, let's say jiu-jitsu and martial arts is the priority, then that needs to be the most important thing that you do that week, training wise and energy wise. And one thing that I noticed with quarantine is I got into all this other stuff. I was messing around with my parallettes and doing all this bodyweight stuff. And it's very easy to start getting into the weeds with that in terms of like, you're like, okay, I can do this move. Let me see if I can do this. Let me see if I can do a handstand or whatever it might be. And you sort of forget, well, why am I doing all this stuff? I'm doing all this stuff so I can get better at fighting stuff. And once the fighting stuff was reintroduced in June or so, I found myself sort of trying to do both and not doing either well. Because if you're not really putting your energy into training the way you should, the training is not going to be good. And you're going to go through that horrible reintroduction thing a lot longer than you need to, because you're tiring yourself out with other stuff that was sort of supplementary at one point, but it kind of took over once the training was taken away. So it comes back to finding that sweet spot. Mm-hmm. And the way that I think that I'm starting to find it again is just remembering that training is the priority. And so putting my energy into that is the most important thing. And if it's the day before and I'm like, well, I could lift or do whatever, but I want to train hard on Sunday, then it might just mean, okay, I'm just going to take a walk. Or like yesterday, I just been doing a lot of shadow boxing. I don't know if you can tell, but I've been doing a lot of shadow boxing. And because to me, that's something that it helps with training, but it also keeps you, you know, it's some decent cardio and things like that, but there's direct applications. Like I noticed with shadow boxing and using the double end ball, my ability to punch people in the face is better. And I feel like this is time tested, because there's times where I don't do it. I'm like, man, I'm not punching people in the face as much. And I've been doing it lately. And I'm like, I feel like I'm punching people in the face more. So I thank those people for putting their face near my fist.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Hey, man. But I think with all that, it's just finding that balance, finding that sweet spot and finding what's most important. And then you can backtrack from there. So once you get your training consistent and to the good level of intensity, now you can start seeing, okay, where are there gaps and things? Like maybe I'm getting overpowered by everyone all the time. Okay, I need to do some more strength training to supplement this to make me better at kicking ass. Mm-hmm. Or it's something where you're like, no matter what, no matter how much I'm training myself, I'm still gassing. So, you know, it could be an issue of maybe doing sprints or doing some intense cardio or something like that. It could be something where maybe you need to work on flexibility or mobility. You find where your weak points are, but I don't think you really find them until you really start focusing in on training first. It's sort of like you hear people talk about when they quit jiu-jitsu for a while and they go, oh, as soon as I get back in shape, then I'm going to start training again. And it's like, to me, that's always backwards. It's like you need to train to get into training shape and then to see from there, okay, what else do I need to do to prevent injuries? Is it like, am I kind of weak? Am I kind of inflexible? Is my cardio lacking? You know, kind of go from there.
Yeah, you get in shape by doing it, right?
Yes, because you and I were talking about before, you were saying that when you were boxing, you had a strength and conditioning coach from UT. And it was always the thing of, am I getting better at boxing? Or am I getting better at box jumps or something like that? You know, like it'd be cool if you expand on that a little bit, because we had talked about this that one time we went to the UT football game, ironically enough, because I think you were saying that you used to run the stairs around there. It was where the baseball field was or something like that. Somewhere around there was where you did a lot.
Yeah, we used to work out at the track there, man. Just the best. We were very fortunate and blessed. So I was telling you that, you know, back in the day, and a lot of fighters, people that fought back in the day will tell you that fighters didn't have strength and conditioning coaches. You know, Ali didn't probably have a strength and conditioning coach. He had his trainer, and it was just old school, right? Like you get up in the morning, you do your road work. You know, you have your workout at the gym. You're going to skip rope. You're going to do your medicine ball drills. You spar. But as the athletes have gotten better, they wanted to be more explosive. They wanted to be faster, stronger, right? When we got our strength and conditioning coach, it took me a while to understand, because I almost had the same feelings towards it. Like, this is what I had been boxing already for a while, but I was like, man, maybe I can increase my speed and power, you know, and be more explosive in the ring and better conditioned in the ring. But it didn't take me long to figure out kind of what you're talking about, that you'll begin your skills that you're depending on, whether it's self-defense or to win a fight, will begin to erode because you're not working those skills. So you have to set the priority. And what I came to realize was that you have your main course, if you will, and then everything else is supplemental. If there's time for it, then you will do it.
Yes.
But first and foremost, you will knock out boxing fundamentals, right? You're gonna skip rope. You're gonna spar. You're gonna do boxing first. If there is time, then you'll do some sort of CrossFit workout. Then you'll, you know, do whatever.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it's been for me. So I agree with it 100%. Not only that, but the people that say, you know, I really want to touch on that because, you know, the thing for me is when this whole COVID-19 stuff started, it was like, okay, I can't train jiu-jitsu, but what can I do? So that way when jiu-jitsu comes back, I can be, you know, I won't like I was telling my son says, looks like such a noob, right? So, you know, I was doing my road work and I've been skipping rope and I've been doing my shadow boxing. And that's kind of routine for me. Like, that's just a part of my life. It doesn't matter what's going on. I'm probably going to always do those things. But at the end of the day, the reason why you do want to focus on whatever it is you're doing, whether it's MMA, whether it's Muay Thai, whether it's wrestling, jiu-jitsu, it is a different type of conditioning. So when a person says, let me get in shape first so that way I can do jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
I don't care what you do. You're not going to get in shape for jiu-jitsu unless you do jiu-jitsu. Right. Like, you can swim laps. You can climb, you know, the sides of mountains. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do your road work. It doesn't matter. Like, you're going to get on the mat and you're still going to get gassed within the like first couple of minutes. Right. Yeah. And that's what I'm seeing now because I'm doing my road work. I'm skipping rope, I'm shadow boxing, but I'm not doing any jiu-jitsu. Like, the only time I'm doing jiu-jitsu is twice a month with you guys. And it shows because I'm not conditioned for jiu-jitsu right now. Right.
Yeah. So, and I think, it's true. It's very specific. And then I think even with your training itself, you figure out what the priority is. Let's just say it is what we do, which I would call sort of strike-based jiu-jitsu, or like, I don't want to call it MMA because it's not the sport of MMA, but it's sort of like all around fighting or freestyle fighting or whatever term floats your boat. Amongst that, if that is the priority, so in other words, if you want to be good all around, then that also has to be finding a sweet spot. And one thing that I noticed that I think I was starting to go a little bit far away was that, you know, Brandon and I were doing a lot of sparring. And we were doing a lot of sparring with headgear and 16-ounce gloves. And that's good. And that I think you need that intensity and you need that, you know, the speed of those shots, because your people are not going to hold back their shots very much with that much padding. But the problem with that is that you get into certain habits of defense and you get into certain habits of understanding range, because you have a big pad at the end of a 16-ounce and you have a big pad on your headgear. So things that hit you wouldn't hit you. Things that you block, so things that where I'm blocking like this, if it was just a fist, it would get through. An uppercut that I can block with my forearms kind of maybe 6 inches away from each other with bare gloves or even with MMA gloves, it's going to get right through. So your defense gets a little bit imprecise and you start getting a little bit too far off in the woods. And I remember George St. Pierre did an interview where he was talking about training and striking, and because he was training with Freddie Roach for a while. For boxing. And he said, it's good to spar with boxers, but you don't want to spar with them too much. You want to spar a few rounds with them to understand the speed and the feeling and the precision and all that. But you don't want to go so much that they start really figuring you out, because now you're just going to get hurt. And it's really not going to help your MMA, because you're going so far into their specialty that it's going to do more damage to you than it's going to do benefit.
100%. And 100%.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to me he's pretty good. So we'll say he knows what he's talking about.
You know, one thing, you know, it's not necessarily off topic, but I will just say this right now. I'm a big proponent. You know, okay, so if I was training a fighter and we were going into a boxing match, you'll game it, right? And we're going to show him or her how to use the gloves and how to roll with shots, and how to catch and move punches around, right? I would say in an actual fight where there's no gloves on, I am a big proponent that head movement is paramount. Because it takes a tremendous amount. It's like hitting a baseball when you see a straight right coming at you, right? Yeah. It's a hard thing to time. And it's even hard for fighters to really catch that punch, right? Yeah. And move it at the right time.
Yeah.
You kind of touched on it. where you don't have the gloves to kind of roll with those punches, right? Like you're trying to block it just with your hands up, and a lot of punches are going to slip through. I believe that you have to, and that's why when I teach boxing, I like to teach defense first, because I believe defense is not instinctual. I believe fighting itself is instinctual. I don't know where it comes from, but like any child pretty much knows how to throw a punch, or at least throw a slap and wrestle around a little bit, right? But if you throw a punch at somebody and they've never trained to react to the punch, it's almost disturbing how they react, right? They completely turn their back to you. They squat on the ground and do the Coco and put your hands like this.
I throw my wallet too when I'm doing that too. I mean, just for example. So
yeah. So what I'd like to do is I like for people to very slowly, you know, we'll start them out with a jab and just have you focused on one punch. Is the only punch you have to defend is a jab. Yeah. And the only way you can defend it is by moving your head in different directions. Never be predictable. But if I could give one suggestion to a lot of guys that are they're training for self-defense, but their primary discipline is jiu-jitsu, is learn how to keep your hands up, learn how to put that chin down, and learn how to work your head movement. I think that's very, very important. And get comfortable with punches coming at you. Yes. If there's one thing that you want to accomplish, is being able to keep your eye on the ball. Yeah. And what I mean by that is that when a punch is coming at you, it's not the instinctual thing to do is to look away from the punch, which is actually the worst thing you can do. Mm-hmm. But it's very common, and it's actually normal. That's, you know, that's what most people are going to do, right? If a car is coming about to run you over, nobody just looks at the car straight through, right? Like you turn your back or something and you look away. And so the fighter has to train. The martial artist has to train to bite. We used to call it biting down on the bullet. As my coach used to call it, biting down on the bullet, and watch that punch come all the way through. And even at the last second, you just make it miss by a fraction, right? Yeah. And that takes a lot of training to do. But I would rather you do that than spend hours and hours and hours hitting the heavy bag. Yeah, I think that's more important.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And it's funny, you know, they always, in different derivations of saying, like, boards don't hit back, heavy bags don't hit back, like whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. You know, because when you talk about somebody like Muhammad Ali, nowadays you see everyone use the focus mitts, and it's almost like a lot of times it's like a dance, like, bop, 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 doing it, it looks all cool. And Ali's era, most of those guys, they didn't really use those mitts at all. From what my understanding is, they did a lot of sparring drills, they did a lot of heavy bag work for power and stuff like that, but they really didn't use the focus mitts. Or at least that's what I've heard. Could be totally wrong, but it's interesting to see tools that make you overconfident with your offense, or like, you know, I mean, it's good to have power, it's good to have all these things, but to me, if I could have anything striking wise, it would be good defense. To me, that's
and I agree, and I know exactly what you're saying about the mitt stuff, right? I don't know either. I don't know how, if that's a good thing. I do want to look into that. I know Mike Tyson, you did a lot of mitt work, but I don't know about these, you know, like Sugar Ray Robinson way back then, right? I don't know what they did, but I know exactly what you're talking about from personal experience. I remember being new to boxing and seeing somebody in the corner working the mitts with the coach, and they looked like Floyd Mayweather. Yeah, and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be sparring this guy here in a second. Yeah. And then it was like whatever he was doing on the mitts, he couldn't apply it in a real life scenario, and you just get slap them around, right?
Yeah.
So it's not, I don't know what to say, but it's not it's not comparable.
It's a supplement, like you were saying. And it could be, we could talk about this for the mitts could be symbolic of somebody who's like a self-help junkie, or like a guru seminar junkie, where you go to all these seminars and you do all these things, and the mitts is like learning it online or learning it in a book or whatever. But the sparring is like going out in the real world and like, I'm going to go do deals. I'm going to actually talk to home sellers. I'm actually talk to brokers or people that are actually doing the do. You know, the sparring is doing the do. And it comes down to that. And to me, it comes down to like, what kind of sparring do you want to be doing? Is it boxing, sparring, kickboxing? Is it MMA? Is it, you know, kind of finding whatever that is and then building all your training around that. So when you're training your wrestling, you're thinking about it from can the guy hit me from here? Can I get this entry without? That's why even in the end we were kind of like bent over a little bit. I'm like, ah, this is bad because this is a bad muscle memory because we both could be kneeing the crap out of each other. So
I was just exhausted. Like yeah, there was no other option for me.
Yeah, Mo kept going, hold me. But I mean, that's why when Kevin and I work our wrestling, we're always like slapping each other a little bit or doing little baby knees because we want to keep in mind we're doing this to take the person down, but also aware that there's always strikes. And then when it's jujitsu, it's always like little slaps here and there. So remembering, okay, yes, you have a good jujitsu position, but are you open to getting hit? And if you build, again, if that becomes your sort of sweet spot, your priority becomes, I want to always be aware of striking. Now everything is working towards a common goal. So when you're grappling, you're working on it in the context of getting better for this freestyle fighting. Same thing with your boxing, same thing with your kickboxing. And then having times where you put it all together too. And then your training has more of a theme that way and more of a balance. And I still will say this till I'm blue in the face. It's so much better. And I'm going to go prove it to the world. We're going to open up these centers that have this type of training one day, because I kept saying law enforcement stuff. Maybe the man is not going to let this happen with funding or whatever, but it's not going to stop this man. This man is going to go out. He's going to build these warehouses. He's going to do this. Feeling a little like Muhammad Ali flowing through me right now. So yeah, I think that, you know, finding that sweet spot in that training and then finding the specificity and the theme of the training is important. But we were talking about this for training. We were also talking about this for real estate earlier in the week, mm-hmm. which was interesting. So it's, and that was something where you were to ask me about, you know, why I've sort of done what I've done the way I've done it. And then I was talking to a banker in Tyler who was asking me sort of the same questions because he's looking to get into investing as well. And I've always found that there is a sweet spot of buying properties below a certain price point. And I'll just say, I think about $100,000 or below. And the reason why I like that so much is because if you take a $50,000 property and yes. you resell it for $80,000 with seller financing, that the difference between the monthly payments on $50,000 versus an $80,000 property are maybe $50 a month at the most. Might even be less if you do it on a 10 or 15 or 20 year note. And most people that are buying things with seller financing, they care about how much down and how much a month. So you're increasing the price from $50,000 to $80,000, which is a huge increase in price. That's over a 50% markup from that property. But because it's below $100,000, because it's below that, it's in the sweet spot, you can do it. Versus when it gets above that price point, it gets way harder to do this. So like a $200,000 house, you're not going to be able to resell it for $300,000 unless it's you're getting just an insanely good deal and you're doing work to it or doing whatever. So once you get past a certain price point, you lose the sweet spot. So that's sort of why I based a huge portion of my business around that, is because there was always that option of just turning around and seller financing it. Now that same $50,000 house, maybe that's $150,000 house if I do certain work to it. Okay, now I could do that as well. But I always have that option to turn that 50 into that 80 and seller financing it in my back pocket. So that to me was always a good, safe, sweet spot. And I was always very aware and sensitive of the possibility of going bankrupt because I met so many people who did in 2008 and 2009. And a lot of that was based on them going for higher price points, more glamorous things, and things that had a lot more downside that they might not have realized. They were heavily leveraged. And there's just no way to make that same math work. And that's what got me into mobile homes. And that's what got me into mobile homes on land and places that you're doing it now. That's what got me into, you know, smaller towns in Texas and stuff like that, was always that relative safety. So the sweet spot for that just always made sense to me. So it's
I love that, because the under the 100 grand is I think right on. And the way I look at it as well is, okay, if I buy a piece of property for $50,000,
yeah.
is there a high probability that I can actually flip it without probably doing anything? Forget yes. about over financing, just straight up flip it yeah. for $100,000.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, a lot of those properties that you buy for 50 grand, you can immediately flip for 100,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way. Once you start buying a property for 100 grand, yeah. you yeah. can't flip it for 200.
Yeah. Exactly.
You might be able to flip it for 150, so you make 50, but you've risked and you've tied up
twice as much
money, and that's exactly. the thing. And that's how much money are you tying up?
Yeah. And that's why, to me, when we talk about, you know, Beyond the Badge and different things, where we're really talking to people that are newer investors, that people that don't want to risk a lot of money. That's why I got into this, because it's like, you know, when I got into mobile homes, it's like the first mobile home I bought was, I think I bought it for $5,000. And it's like, yeah, that's still a chunk of change. I'm not saying the $5,000 is nothing. But when I used to buy site-built homes, let's say I was buying even 14 years ago in Austin, I'm still buying, that's, let's say, $150,000 home, which straight up does not exist in this town anymore. But even back then, you probably have to put down 10 or 15%. So let's say you put 10% down, that's $15,000. So it's three times as much you put just as the down payment. And now you're on the hook for $135,000. You're on the hook every month for that much money, that much of the loan. So it's way, way, way more of a risk versus just $5,000. It's like, man, if this thing loses 50% of its value, I've lost $2,500. Versus the $150,000 home, if it loses that, I've lost $75,000. No more Bugatti for me. So, you know what I mean? It's just a huge difference in terms of risk and all that. And I think that can be a lot more palatable to people than being like, you're on the hook for this much. Or they're like, oh, well, you're using other people's money. It's like, it doesn't matter. You owe somebody a huge chunk of change versus maybe this is something you can literally do yourself. And especially once you throw in seller financing, now it's something where you can buy on those cheap points and a lot of times get the seller to carry the note. So now on that $50,000 home, maybe you put down $5,000 and you take payments for the rest of the time. And now you sell it for 80 and you're doing, you know, a wraparound. So now you've got maybe a $10,000 down payment, and then you're getting a couple $100 more than you're paying the original owner. So there's all sorts of ways to make money where you're not risking a lot of money and it doesn't take a lot of money. And to me, that is the sweet spot, because you can teach that to somebody who doesn't have a lot of money, doesn't have a lot of credit. And to me, the other thing is that I'm always terrified of giving bad advice. Like, so, okay, my buddy Dennis Dombrow, who you've talked to before, Dennis has fought in, I think he fought in Strike Force before. He's fought in a lot of different organizations for MMA. He competed in one of the EBIs against Barrett Yoshida, against Marvin Castell, and another one. So he's, you know, good black belt. I've known Dennis since he was a teenager. And I remember one time he told me, he goes, hey, man, I used something that you taught me in a fight. And like, I was terrified that his next words were going to be like, and it didn't work and I hate you. But he's like, I'm like, what happened? I didn't even ask him what it was. I'm just like, what happened? He's like, oh, it worked. I'm like, oh, thank Christ. Cause I'm just terrified of like giving somebody bad advice and then being like, yeah, thanks, man. Now I'm freaking bankrupt or whatever.
I don't know. What do you think is worse? Do you think it's when it comes to fighting, giving bad advice, and they're like, man, I did what you told me to do and I got knocked out? Or when it comes to business and they're like, man, I did what you told me to do and now I'm homeless.
Well, I mean, I guess in a way, if the fighting is their business and you've doubly screwed them, but I would rather give bad fighting advice. Cause yes, at the end of the day, it's like, dude, I'm a 46-year-old real estate investor. Why are you taking, I've never had a fight in my life. Why are you taking fighting advice from me?
Your first mistake.
Shame on you. I was giving you a sucker test and you failed it by listening to me.
Hey man, you know, and in terms of using other people's money, you know, I love what you're talking about when the owner financing stuff,
yes,
because, you know, cause a lot of people, when they talk about leverage, or at least when I've heard the gurus talk about using other people's money, it's usually like taking out a loan,
yeah,
using the bank's money is usually, yeah, the other people are the banks.
Yeah.
At least that's how it's been explained to me and a lot of the stuff that I read up on. But what, you know, like this deal that I'm doing now, right? In Spring Branch, I bought it with owner financing.
Yeah.
And I'm going to use someone else's money to act. So I actually put 25 down, right, to get the property. And let's say I owe $35,000 to pay off the property.
Yeah.
Well, my down payment from whoever I seller finance it to is going to be $35,000 down. Yeah. So I've used that person's money to essentially buy half of this property for me.
Yeah.
And then they're going to be paying on a monthly basis to complete that note.
Yeah. It's beautiful. And I think it's such a powerful tool. And to me, it's something that I always sort of go back to in terms of looking at stuff, even if I, you know, maybe I'm not, you know, cause I'm looking at the commercial stuff and that's a little bit different. But that core, I think, is such an important way to build a business around, because you can build up money without the risk of losing a lot of money. And to me, that's so important. I'd rather build up money slower and make sure it's secure versus, you know, I see people doing these crazy things in apartments and other stuff where it's like, man, yeah, you might make a lot of money in 5 years, but number one, you're making basically no money right now. And not only more are they going and doing a mortgage with a bank, but they're syndicating, which means they've got the money they owe the bank, and then they've got the money for the down payment. They didn't even make that money. They borrowed that money from a bunch of people who are expecting to get a return like on a monthly or quarterly basis from them. And that's cool. And I mean, I'm in some of those deals as one of the people hopefully getting the money, but man, that is an enormous risk. And
I remember when we were knocking out the podcast back in your office up north, and that's really when you were going through the syndication stuff.
Yeah.
And you did some of those syndication deals because you wanted to learn ins and outs of how to do them. See whether or not it was for you, wasn't for you. Yeah. I didn't really know. I was kind of along for the ride and I was learning from you. But man, I have a completely different take on syndication after listening to someone like Tom McKay. And I don't know even if he's 100% correct, but he just makes it seem so sleazy, right? And if he's correct, then it is kind of sleazy if he's correct.
Yeah.
Because basically what he's saying is that, let's say I'm a guy and I get 100 people to invest with me, but the deal goes south. Well, I can just walk away from the deal, and is my understanding, right? Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what the repercussions are, but a lot of those people have probably lost, you know, they believe in you.
Yes.
And they think there's going to be a good return.
Yeah.
I like his, I kind of lean towards more his idea now of like, hold on to your own money, do it yourself.
Yeah.
And what we're talking about right now, you can make $1 million from doing a bunch of small deals. And that really is when I think about the sweet spot, I think about risk versus reward. Yeah. And the sweet spot is somewhere in the middle.
Yes.
If you're risking too much, even if there's a large potential reward, you've gone outside the sweet spot.
Yeah. 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 You're totally right. And it's funny. So what I love about Tom McKay says also is that, you know, a lot of these syndicators haven't really made money. They've just raised other people's money, and then they get an acquisition fee to do the deal. So a lot of times they get like 2 or 3% of the selling price in their pocket when the deal closes. But that's kind of weird because you're buying the deal and you're getting paid to buy the deal with other people's money. And then you're right, a lot of these people don't have much or any of their own money in the deal. So yeah, you could argue that their reputation will obviously suffer a lot. But one thing that makes me suspicious is that I haven't heard of many or any of these people that have done this stuff prior to 2011. And the reason I mention that is 2011 is when the economy really started to recover and you were getting a lot of apartment buildings that were coming online that were relatively undervalued, and it was getting easier to get financing for them. So you had people that started buying these things, and because now the economy is recovering and they're buying them in cities where rent is starting to grow pretty rapidly, you basically could just hold on to this thing for a year or two and sell it for way more. Now, if you accelerated the process by increasing the rents and managing it better and stuff like that, then you could make even more money. And I'm not discounting that. I'm not saying that's easy, because it's not, but they were in the perfect time to do it. Now it's going to be interesting going forward, seeing what happens when you have like places like New York, you have huge rent decreases. In San Francisco, you're seeing rent decreases. Things that a lot of these guys swore never happened. Oh, rents never go down. Yeah, they do. And now they especially do. And now you can't evict people either. So,
and I was going to ask you something about that, Carter. What are the potential consequences? Because we haven't seen them yet.
Yeah.
And what I mean by this is people that are not paying their mortgages and not paying their rent.
Yeah.
What are the long-term effects?
I don't know. That's a great question, because it's, you know, the Band-Aid has been that the federal government keeps coming in and subsidizing this. How long can they keep doing that? I mean, I guess theoretically they can do it forever. But sooner or later, you know.
So when you say subsidizing, are they paying the banks?
Not really, but I mean, they're paying people, you know, $400. I think it was $600 a month before. Now it's $400 to help with rent and things like that.
But so are people using that money to pay their rent in turn?
It seems that way from the deals that I've seen.
Okay.
Most of them have had good collection rates over the last 2 months. So it seems that way right now. The real question is that, you know, as things go on and you know, certain jobs just go away forever, you know, certain businesses just close down and won't reopen. Well, what happens to the people that worked in these places that are more sort of working class people, which is, these are people getting hit by far the worst with all the COVID, because a lot of these jobs, people who are all working online and things like that, they kind of forget that there's jobs out there where you can't work online. Like if you're a police officer, you can't just literally phone it in. You actually do have to show up. I mean, if you're a firefighter, you can't zoom in on that fire and go, yeah, they should spread. You got to be the one doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're working in a factory, if you're working construction, you know, you actually have to be there. So, you know, I wonder what's going to happen if some of these jobs go away and things like that. Is that really going to start affecting the bottom line that these apartments make and decreasing returns to the point where maybe they start losing money and they can't start paying their mortgage? Because there's been mortgage relief programs. And from what I can see so far, enough rents have been coming in that everyone's been able to cover their mortgage and everything's been okay. I don't know if that's going to be a temporary thing, a permanent thing. I don't know if the economy is
Because there's already talks about ending, you know, some of the relief packages at some point, that they anticipate them being ended. But the people that are utilizing that relief, will they get another job, right?
Well, that becomes a question too. So for instance, my wife has a friend who opened up a bagel shop, and they're damn good bagels. It's on Lamar. It's over near Ryan Villalobos' jiu-jitsu school, Vow Jiu-Jitsu. So if you want to get in, learn some great leg locks from a true disciplined master of jiu-jitsu, Ryan Villalobos. Incredibly knowledgeable, incredibly good at the whole thing, but especially leg locks. And then afterwards, you're like, I want a bagel and locks. Boom, I'm sorry. I did that. You can go to this, I forget the name of the bagel store, but it's right there on Lamar. It's great place. But so she's had problems where, because of the unemployment benefits and things like that, all of her workers are like, we're making more money being unemployed than we would be coming into the shop. So she's having to basically, she and her husband are just working 24/7 now, trying to keep this place afloat. That's a reality for a lot of these jobs. A lot of these business owners, they're having trouble getting their people back because they are literally making more money being unemployed. Now, the other side, to me, it's, and again, this is another sweet spot issue, because if it's too far that way, then it's like, well, yeah, why would somebody go? And if you're constantly saying how dangerous COVID is still, would you want to expose yourself to this on a daily basis with the general public for literally less money than you get for staying at home? That seems silly. But on the other hand, if you're just like, ah, you know what, sink or swim, baby. Well, that's not really fair either, because a lot of these businesses were put down and things like that by a pandemic they had no control of, that they weren't managing their business well. And it was literally the government saying, you literally can't do this. So that's not fair either. So it's a weird balance, and it's finding that sweet spot. And this is a difficult job because this is something that's never really happened before and yada, yada. But I think finding that sweet spot is important for that too, because if somebody if it makes no financial sense for somebody to work, then there's still people that are going to do it, but to rely on people to do that in an incentive-based mentality, which is the one I tend to think works the best, then that incentive needs to be that you can have a little bit of money to supplement this and that, but you're barely going to make it through. But if you work, you'll make money on top of that. And that's, you know, that's going to all sorts of different things politically and philosophies and stuff like that. But I think that it's a balance. And so far, it doesn't seem like that balance has been found. But those bagels are delicious, so people should have them. I wish I remember the name of the place, but it's okay. I think finding that balance and finding that sweet spot and finding that even in life itself, I think is really important. And I think there's a lot of, for people that are listening to podcasts on getting themselves better and striving to do more, there needs to be a balance even in that, because there's something that I think people call hustle culture. Have you heard this before?
Yes.
And it's almost like this weird peer pressure to see like who can sleep the least, who's working the most, who's grinding the best, blah, 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 blah. And it turns into this thing where it's like, who gets the first heart attack? Who gets the second one? You know, I've got high blood pressure. You know, I mean, it's like,
I wonder how much of that is hype.
That's
when
what I'm
saying. When the cameras are off, I wonder how they're probably all sleeping.
Yeah, that's the thing. So it's because there's this tendency to, you know, you compare yourself to others, and then there's this tendency to want to be like, well, I'm like this because I just work hard, or I just do this, I just do that. And it's like, well, I'm not saying that you don't have to work hard, but it needs to be enjoyable and sustainable, just like your training, just like your business, just like your business relationships, just like your relationships. Because if it's not that, if it's just this constant slog, the way they make it out to be, it's like, well, that's just miserable. And if you're just relying on sheer grit and discipline to get through, you're not going to last. And so to me, it's like when you see the Grant Cardones, the Gary Vaynerchuks or whatever, these guys are super social people. They like talking to other people. So yeah, they're working, but they're doing what they like doing, which is talking for the most part. And they're good talkers and they're good salesmen. But you know, when I see Gary Vaynerchuk and he's meeting this person to talk and meeting that person talking, it's like, well, dude, I've worked in fish factories before, unloading salmon and driving forklifts and stuff like that. I consider that hard work. When you see, when you're, the salmon tote is going up and salmon slime is hitting you in the face and you're in an ice pit and you literally have to do this. This is what I did in Petersburg, Alaska in the summer of 95. Like, that to me is hard work. Meeting people in a comfortable air conditioning place with a, you know, a tea or a beer or whatever it might be and talking about stuff, that's kind of fun. That's kind of exciting. I mean, maybe it's tiring and things like that, but it's not like, oh, I'm just, oh, I'm like, you can't do that. So it's like finding ways to block off. And I've been reading different books on that. And it's the idea of, you know, what I've been doing lately is my early morning is a workout and walking the dog. And then it's like maybe about 8 o'clock, 8:30 until like 11:30 or so is more social stuff. Cause I feel like I like either writing stuff, talking to people, or looking at properties in the morning. Noontime is sometimes training or sometimes other things. And then afternoon is more doing like accounting stuff, maybe some more phone calls, things like that. But it's like, I find that if I break it up, I liked putting the more social things, the more stuff that I look like that I'm not as keen on, because I don't mind talking to people, but I'm not a super extrovert. So it's a little more difficult for me. So I do it in the morning, but I don't really do it that much in the afternoon. But I find like it's way more productive, because to me, it's like, I don't want to sit there and be like, oh, I work hard on everybody. I want to be that I'm more efficient and more honest with knowing when I work well and when I don't work well, and putting myself in the most advantageous position for both things and doing that consistently. I would much rather do it that way than just be like, oh, I just work harder, because it's like, that's such a hard thing to like emulate. You know what I mean? It's like people,
it's not for everybody.
And it's not for everybody.
And if you say that that's the only way to be successful, I don't believe it. I think there's 100 ways to skin a cat. Not that you would ever skin a cat. And the only thing that was better than the summer of 95 was the summer of 85. That's right.
What happened in the summer of 85?
I don't know. Wasn't that a Bryan Adams song?
That was summer of 69, actually.
I was way off.
Yeah. Had a band, they tried real hard.
You said what happened in the summer of 1985.
Well, because if it was 1986, now we've got like the movie Aliens came out. We got a lot of good movies coming out in 86.
You're I was like, 12. Bro, that was the summer of 69.
Yeah, seriously.
That was
this is gonna shock Coco, but I was not even alive in the summer of 69. That's how long ago that was. So
yeah. But you're absolutely right. Extremism in anything I feel is bad. Yeah. If you sleep too much, it's bad. If you eat too much, it's bad. If you drink too much, it's bad, right? Like anything you do to the extreme, I think is bad. But I also think that it's something that people can sell very easily, because people like extreme sports, right? They want to see the guy climb Mount Everest twice on the same day. Right.
You're totally right. You're totally right. And they do this even in jiu-jitsu, they do this. I remember a guy came up to me over at Cooper's, nice guy. And he's not like, not old like me, but not super young. I would say he's probably in his early 30s. And I remember him telling me, he's like, yeah, man, I've been watching the way the Atos guys train, and I want to train like that. I want to do this. I want to do that. And I'm like, so you want to be a professional jiu-jitsu guy? Is that what you want to do? Like, because it's like, again, they're selling this like, oh, they work so hard, this, that. And it's like, I'm not trying to pick on these specific guys, but it's like, number one, you realize most of these guys have literally no money whatsoever and are borderline broke at all time periods. Not that that matters, but that's just if you want to raise kids or do whatever, that's going to be difficult. Number two, most of them have a very finite window of a competition career. Yes, they're going to train hard and do this and do that for a couple years. And then a lot of them are not going to be training much at all after that. Number three, I'm not saying this. I'm not even alleging this, but I'm guessing that there might be some supplements, some performance enhancing supplements. We used to call them PEDs for short. That's quite possible. And that's quite prevalent in the jiu-jitsu world. So it's like, you're comparing yourself to professional athletes who are younger than you, who do this for a living, who are probably supplemented with recovery drugs. And it's not, I'm not hating on performance enhancing drugs, but the reality of what they do is one of the main benefits of a lot of these steroids is they allow you to recover faster. They allow muscle to recover much faster. So you can train super hard twice a day versus somebody who is not taking those drugs. You cannot do that. Your body will break down. But they're selling this idea of like, if you just did this, all this would be possible. And that's not really telling the full story. And it's making normal people feel bad about themselves. Like, I got to train harder. Well, I'll buy their t-shirt and I'll buy their video.
Because it's more sexy. And it goes right back into how you were talking about the reason people went broke in 2008 is because they wanted to invest in things that were more sexy.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But if we just go back to kindergarten and we remember the story of the tortoise and the hare.
That's right.
Slow and steady wins the race.
Yes, it does.
Slow and steady wins the race.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that tortoise, you know why? Is that tortoise found the sweet spot of a good pace.
That's right.
There we go. I think that's good enough.
Yeah. Awesome. My brother, that was a let's pay some bills. So always be sure to check out Robles.com, makers of the world's finest custom jiu-jitsu apparel. If you own your own jiu-jitsu academy, check out Robles.com. We can make your own custom apparel for your jiu-jitsu academy. Also check out UrbanMaskCo.com. We make masks for businesses and individuals. Check out Carter Buys Homes. Also check out Calum Callista. I think you can find him on like Trap Jiu-Jitsu as well. Mm-hmm. BJJ Way of Life. He also has a Sneaky Submissions on BJJ Fanatics. Check out Steven Hordensky. Super cool dude, man. I like Steve a lot. He gets on Facebook Live every once in a while and he goes on these rants, but I'll just watch him,
man. He's keeping it real, man. He's being honest.
So
he's
open, real. Yeah, and that's what I love about him, man. He keeps it real and he just says what's on his mind, but he's a man, has a heart of gold. And if someone really knows jiu-jitsu, Steve really knows it. I mean, like every time I describe him, he's the type of guy that he wakes up, he's thinking about jiu-jitsu. He goes to bed, he's thinking about jiu-jitsu. Jiu-Jitsu on the Go is a great online platform to supplement your regular training. Hopefully you're still supporting your jiu-jitsu academies, so that way they'll be there when we get back on the mats full time. If you want to take control of your own training, you probably need mats for your garage. Go check out Fuji Mats and Facility Design. And if you live in the Austin area or surrounding area, check out Chaparral Moving. Ask for Tony, tell him Mo sent you, and he may or may not hook you up with a discount, but he will hook you up with the absolute best move of your life. To see this episode or older episodes, go check out the jiu-jitsuoflife.com. Subscribe to us on Apple iTunes, leave us a review, share, like, all that type of thing. As always, I'm Mo, that's Carter, and we thank you guys for watching, and we wish you guys nothing but the best, both on and off the mat. Take care.
Thank you, guys.
That's it for this episode of the Jiu-Jitsu of Life. Your hosts are Carter Fisk and Mo Siddiqui. This podcast is brought to you by Roll Bliss Custom Kimonos, makers of the world's finest custom BJJ apparel. You can subscribe to the Roll Bliss newsletter to get exclusive content at www.rollblissgi.com. You can find more episodes of this show at our website, thejiujitsuoflife.com, and you can subscribe at Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we wish you a great week, both on and off the mat.